Welcome to Sunday Sermons and other recordings from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Davis, California. Please visit our website at www.uudavis.org for further information.
Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Davis. I'm Reverend Morgan McLean, the Minister for Congregational Life.
Good morning. I'm Megan Kelly, your Worship Associate this morning. There is nothing you need to bring with you to be welcomed here. No right beliefs or proof of citizenship. No eternal optimism or clarity of conviction. No boundless courage or endless experience.
You do not need to know what brought you here or how you will solve that problem you are turning over and over and over in your mind. You do not need to be already perfect or even halfway. You belong in this circle where grace meets us where we are but does not leave us as it finds us.
Love lives in each of us, yet is somehow more than everyone together. Love lives with us here, where life pulses and rages and heals and transforms, creating us and this day anew once again.
Come, let us worship together. Every Sunday, you're invited to write a milestone in the table in the back and light a small chalice to acknowledge your joy or sorrow. Today, we light two pillar candles. One for all the joys, the hopes, the celebrations in this room, knowing that these moments are brighter when we share them. And we light our second pillar candle for all the sorrows, the worries, the mourning in this room, knowing that when we come together, we are cared for. We come into this space in the complexity of all that is our lives, and we create this hour of caring together.
We light this chalice, a symbol of Unitarian Universalism, and these words are from Reverend L.A. McCrae. Let us champion each other through the journey of life, attentive to the path and its challenges, illuminating the dark places, and leading with love. One, two, three, four, five, breathe. One, two, three, four, five, breathe. Elbows up, fingers together. One, two, three, four, five, breathe. I grew up in water, bathtubs, pools, rivers and lakes, sprinklers, puddles, even the occasional bucket. I learned how to connect with my breath and tell my lungs what to do very early. If you don't do this in water, you can't keep going. I remember the sputtering feeling of breathing in water instead of air and feeling that I would sink right to the bottom if I did not remember how to talk to my lungs. This sputtering feeling makes me feel alive. It connects me to a little piece of risk and suffering and shows me that I can overcome it and make it my own. One, two, three, four, five, breathe. I was on swim team for many years and counted strokes of my arms to stay balanced and to remember to breathe. One, two, three, four, five, breathe. I was a distance swimmer and would often participate in races that took 15 minutes to complete. If I stopped paying attention, I would not be winning that race, and I would possibly be sputtering to the edge of the pool in a very ungraceful and painful way, depending on what attention was lost. One, two, three, four, five, breathe. This pattern of breath forces you to breathe on both sides of your body. Most people favor one side or the other and find that the other side is slightly slower or clunkier for them to take a breath on. Counting the breath forces you to do what is hard. It forces your mind to override the natural tendencies of your body. It creates balance where there would not have been on its own. One, two, three, four, five, breathe. Breathing on both sides can be a challenge, but it has a cause and a reason. It helps prevent shoulder pain and injuries. It makes for a more balanced flow through the water. It makes your mind and body talk to one another. It provides an attainable challenge to find more balance. One, two, three, four, five, breathe. I try to find ways to replicate this in my daily life. Where can I count breaths and find more balance? Where are the attainable challenges that I can connect with and possibly overcome? I recently presented myself with the challenge of establishing a habit of working out in the mornings. I was missing many days of working out after being at work late and could feel myself getting antsier and pent up. At first, these mornings felt like sputtering. The first morning when my alarm went off and I saw 4:15 a.m. shining back at me, I wasn't sure if I had lost my mind. By 6 o'clock, when I was done with a workout and showering, I felt accomplished and energized. As the weeks went on, I started to enjoy the feeling of being awake before most of the world around me. Driving through Davis, seeing dark houses, and being one of the only cars on the road. Hearing the birds waking up as I headed home, I felt connected to the day and more energized throughout it after working out first thing. I have a new routine, a new rhythm, not one that felt natural at first, but one that is worth my attention. One, two, three, four, five, breathe. May we all find a rhythm and flow in changes and push ourselves to overcome doable challenges. Consider where you might need to count breaths in your own life and make the choice to take on the challenge. One, two, three, four, five, breathe.
I found the Buddha at TJ Maxx last week. Four different Buddhas, actually. I found it funny because in some ways Buddhism has become synonymous with spirituality in our culture. But how do you capture 2,500 years of history in the artwork aisle of a big box store? This morning, I hope to briefly explore the basic tenets of Buddhism, distinguish between some schools that we're most familiar with here in the States, and consider how Unitarian Universalists might integrate some of these practices into our own spiritual lives. Buddhism is a religion practiced by 7% of the world population. 99% of those Buddhists are found in Asia. Buddhism emerged in India around the year 500 BCE. That was a dynamic time for religious thought. The people were looking at the Vedas, the Hindu scriptures, and taking them further than they ever had before. The Hindu culture is based on a caste system, and even then, the teachings of the Buddha challenged that system. Still, in some Hindu traditions today, the Buddha is considered an avatar of the supreme god Vishnu, and so Buddhist practice is considered just one expression of Hinduism. In 2016, I had the opportunity to visit Sarnath, the site of the Buddha's first sermon in India. The site has been developed as a place of pilgrimage, and it was there that I saw how many countries were represented practicing this major religion. There are temples and markers built by Buddhists in Japan and Thailand, Tibet, Sri Lanka, and many others. In that area of India, 500 years before the birth of Jesus, there was a young man born into an upper caste, likely a local prince. The story of Siddhartha begins with a dream his mother had of a white elephant entering her womb. When this child was born, a sage teacher foretold that the boy would become a great teacher himself and achieve enlightenment. He would become a Buddha, meaning simply an enlightened one. The boy's mother died a week after his birth, and his father brought him up in luxury with the hope that the boy would not choose that life that was predicted for him. The boy had three palaces and wanted for nothing. He was married at age 16. He continued to live in luxury, completely sheltered from the outside world. When he was 29, he was outside one of his palaces, and he saw four sights that would change his life. He saw an old man, a sick man, a corpse, and an ascetic, a holy man. He was troubled by what he witnessed in the pain and suffering of the world. But when he saw that holy man, a man devoted to meditation and simple living, Siddhartha felt hope that he could be free from the suffering of life following that example. He left his wife and his own newborn child and his three palaces and his life of luxury, and he put on the yellow robes of an ascetic. He tried many different practices over the following 6 years. He faced a tempter but managed to sit in meditation, vanquishing the evil spirit. That night, while in meditation, he attained enlightenment. Now at age 35, he realized the Four Noble Truths, becoming the tenets of Buddhism still revered today. Those Four Noble Truths: suffering exists. It is part of the human experience. Suffering has a cause, namely, the anxiety that comes with wanting change and material things. There is a cessation to suffering. This truth happens when desires and ignorance leave our minds completely. And fourth, there is a path to end suffering. These four truths are the central teachings from the Buddha. He took this message and he began to gain followers and a community of monks. Buddha and his followers see human beings as suffering primarily from the distortion of reality, which occurs by the way of greed and anger and ignorance. He preached a middle way between extreme self-indulgence and extreme self-depravity. This middle way was the Eightfold Path. We see this path represented at TJ Maxx and other places by the Dharma wheel. It's like a ship's wheel with eight spokes, reminding Buddhists of the eight key elements of Buddha's teachings about how to live in order to achieve enlightenment. The eight paths: right understanding, right thought, right speech, action, livelihood, right effort, mindfulness, right concentration. Following this path leads to enlightenment, with the ultimate goal of achieving nirvana. Nirvana is commonly understood as Buddhist heaven, but that's not quite right. Nirvana isn't a place. It's a state of mind. It's bliss, a fully liberated mind, or what other traditions might call a liberated soul. Fun fact, I typed in nirvana into Google, and the whole first page of results didn't even mention Buddhism. The Buddha continued to teach and gain disciples. He lived to age 80, And at the time, he knew he was dying, and he wanted to prepare his followers for his death, and he asked them to spread his teachings out of compassion for the world. He died leaving an oral traditions of these teachings for generations to follow. Within the first few hundred years of his death, the fragmented followers formed 18 different schools of Buddhism. It spread from India to China, Japan, Myanmar, Laos, Vietnam, Thailand, and Cambodia. Still, like any religion in the world, it's practiced differently depending on your tradition, your geographic location, and your situation in life. While many of these schools still exist, most scholars identify just three major schools of Buddhism: Theravada, Mahayana, and Vajrayana schools. We see these traditions, these three distinct schools in popular culture today that we are familiar with. Insight meditation, Zen Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, each of those are from different schools. Many of the early Buddhists here in the States come from the Theravada tradition. Today, some popular teachers in this tradition are Tara Brach and Sharon Salzberg. You might have heard those names. It's argued that this is the oldest form of Buddhism, with a practice focused on one's experiences and personal search. This tradition is found in insight meditation as well as in the loving kindness meditation. Theravada Buddhists generally say they are atheists, unlike the other schools of Buddhism, which do celebrate some traditional deities from Hinduism and other local traditions. Still, it's important to note that the Buddha is not seen as God or a supreme God more venerated than other celestial beings. Within the Mahayana tradition, there are many branches, including Zen Buddhism. Thich Nhat Hanh is a famous Buddhist. He's a Vietnamese Zen Buddhist. Zen Buddhism focuses on meditation rather than scriptures, religious rites, or other practices. And they believe that enlightenment is attainable by anyone. Zen has become part of our vocabulary, associated with total calm and peace. Within this tradition, practitioners look inward, knowing that human nature is the same as Buddha nature. We also hear a lot about Tibetan Buddhism, which is from that third Vajrayana school. It's a more abstract branch of Buddhism. We know the Dalai Lama and his rock star status fills and sells out football stadiums. The Dalai Lama is a particular position. It's a title. The current Dalai Lama, Tenzin Gyatso, is the 14th Dalai Lama. And he even won a Nobel Peace Prize in 1989 for his nonviolence movement in the liberation of Tibet from Chinese rule. The Dalai Lama and other lamas are reincarnated leaders. Their identities are revealed by interpreting a series of dreams and oracles and signs. Tibetan Buddhism tradition uses oracles such as those, and also mantras, a set of words that are seen to have special powers when used in ritual. We know about these things in Buddhism from our daily lives. And here in the Unitarian Universalist tradition, many of us draw inspiration and spiritual enlightenment in some ways. In our many ways that we practice our own search for truth and meaning, we find that we are interconnected in the web of life, and this thought aligns very well with varied Buddhist practices. We share that we do not focus on a particular deity, but rather presence. Many of us do seek a middle way, living in the balance of greed and charity, of indulgence and depravity. We might not choose to leave our families, but we do try to be and become our best selves. There is a lot of wisdom there. There's a lot of wisdom outside just loving kindness that we can take from Buddhism. There's a common image of Buddhists as detached from worldly things. Yet Buddhists are fully engaged citizens of the world and find their religion intersecting with politics a lot. There is the famous incident in 1963 of a Buddhist monk, Thich Quang Duc, who set himself on fire in protest of the persecution of the Buddhists in South Vietnam by the then Catholic president. Extremists still exist, and in Myanmar and Sri Lanka, especially right now, although Buddhists represent a vast majority of the population, they espouse a practice of nationalistic policies against the Muslim minorities. Buddhists there have not gone all the way to even denounce the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya, and they have gone on hunger strikes to protest Muslim governors and even ousted two Muslim governors this summer. In India, back to where it all began, Buddhists represent today less than 1% of the population there. Buddhists who are still in India are part of a political movement based on the liberation of the Dalit or untouchable caste, which started in the 1950s. There was a Dalit leader named Ambedkar who challenged Gandhi's reliance on Hinduism, because Ambedkar said that if we use Hinduism, it's a religion that enshrines inequality because of the caste system. And so Ambedkar converted to Buddhism and, in fact, staged a mass conversion in 1956 in opposition to Hindu rule. In the United States, there are American Buddhists that have emerged from converts in different traditions. Anti-death penalty activist David Kaczynski, whose brother is Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, became a Tibetan Buddhist. And he had this to say about the practice of Dharma in politics. As Buddhists, we understand that there is no truth or wisdom without compassion. Engaged Buddhism represents an antidote to the politics of fear, hate, violence, and separation. We know that truth and transformation can be realized through listening and paying attention, as well as through speaking and taking action. We are the ones who don't turn our heads away, who abide with discouragement, and who avoid becoming a mirror image of the enemy, because in the end, we have no enemies. Buddhists are engaged citizens, grounded in and defending their faith. They take their religion to the streets and to the voting booth. Unitarian Universalists are similarly engaged politically, yet I'm not sure that we often ground our social activism or our voting on our spirituality or our faith. I find that a very compelling challenge from our Buddhist cousins. Still, impermanence is a central idea of Buddhism, and one that finds resonance with many of us, maybe giving up some of that world. This is the idea that everything around us is in a constant state of flux. It is us trying to control that change or to get something out of it that is the root cause of our suffering. Cultivating an understanding of impermanence of all things allows us to let go of the outcome and live more fully into the present moment. This idea of living in the present asks each of us to be self-aware of how our pasts are telling stories about what our futures should be. We can probably all learn from accepting that change happens, and the more comfortable we become with allowing change, the freer, the happier, the Buddhists might say, the more enlightened we become. here in this church. If you're interested in learning more about Buddhist spirituality, there are several spirituality groups that draw from Buddhism, and you can see them listed out in the social hall. They're always in the ARE catalog. There are many ways that we seek here. The joy of Unitarian Universalism is that our concept of the ultimate is big enough and open enough to take pieces of different traditions to bring the holy into human existence and to believe that everyone has an equal share in it. Buddhism, like all the religions of the globe, offers us insight to be more fully present, to be more fully human. We can continue to learn from this ancient wisdom. We can practice loving kindness. We can practice meditation. We can find a spiritual centering in all that we do. In meditation, concentrating on breathing is an important part of that practice, and it helps us focus inward, shutting off the other scripts in our minds and just connecting with the wholeness of our bodies. We are all on this path to enlightenment. Each new day, each new interaction, each new piece of information helps us understand who we are in relation to the world around us, helps us understand when we need to let go, when we need to just breathe. As we come to the end of our service, we extinguish the pillar candles, acknowledging those sorrows still go with us, and knowing the joys are carried forward too. And we extinguish our chalice, this light of truth that beckons us to be and become our best selves. And if you are ready to take your faith out into the world, there is a rally on Tuesday evening in Central Park, supported in part by our immigration justice team and the Davis Phoenix Coalition, organizing about the Supreme Court ruling on DACA students. And after the second service here, you can join us in the Seng House Room to make signs for that. I invite you now to reach out for a hand or a shoulder for our benediction. These words from the Metta Sutta.
No matter if you live far or near, no matter what your weakness or your strength, there is not one alive we count outside. May deeper joy for all now come at length.
And may this congregation say, Amen.